Side 8. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 250. But out at the horizon, out near the burnished edge of the world, who are these visitors standing, these robed figures, perhaps at this distance, hundreds of miles tall, their faces serene, unattached, like the Buddha's, bending over the sea, impassive, indeed as the angel that stood over Lübeck during the Palm Sunday raid, come that day neither to destroy nor to protect, but to bear witness to a game of seduction. It was the next to last London took before her submission, before that liaison that would bring her at length to the eruption and scarring of the wasting pox noted on Roger Mexico's map, latent in this love she shares with the night-going rake Lord Death. Because sending the RAF to make a terror raid against civilian Lübeck was the unmistakable long look that said, "Hurry up and fuck me," that brought the rockets hard and screaming, the A-4s, which were to have been fired anyway, a bit sooner instead. What have the watchmen of World's Edge come tonight to look for? Deepening on now, monumental beings, stoical, on toward slag, toward ash, the color the night will stabilize at, tonight. What is there grandiose enough to witness? Only Slothrop here, and Sir Stephen, blithering along, crossing shadow after long prison bar shadow cast by the tall trunks of palms lining the esplanade. The spaces between the shadows are washed a very warm sunset red now, across grainy chocolate beach. There seems to be nothing happening of any moment. No traffic whispering in the circular driveways. No milliards of francs being wagered because of a woman or an entente of nations at any of the tables inside. Only the somewhat formal weeping of Sir Stephen, down now on one knee in the sand, still warm from the day, soft and strangled cries of despair held in, so testifying to all the repression he ever underwent that even Slothrop can feel in his own throat sympathetic flashes of pain for the effort it is clearly costing the man.
"Oh, yes, yes, you know, I can't, no. I assumed that you knew, but then why should they tell you? They all know I'm an office joke. The people even know. Nora's been the sweetheart of the psychic crowd for years and years. That's always good for some bit of copy in the News of the World."
"Oh, yeah, Nora. That's that dame that was caught that time with the kid who can change his color, right? Wow. Sure, that Nora Dotson truck, I knew your name was familiar."
But Sir Stephen has gone on. "Had a son, yes, we came complete with sensitive son, boy about your age, Frank. I think they sent him to Indochina. They're very polite when I ask, very polite, but they won't let me find out where he is. They're good chaps at Fitzmaurice House, Slothrop. They mean well. It's been, most of it's been my fault. I did love Nora, I did, but there were other things, important things. I believed they were, I still do, I must. As she got along, you know, they do get that way. You know how they are demanding, always trying to drag you into bed. I couldn't," shaking his head, his hair now incandescent orange in this twilight. "I couldn't. I'd climbed too far, another branch. Couldn't climb back down to her. She might even have been happy with even a touch now and then. Listen, Slothrop, your girl, your Katya, she's very lovely, you know."
"I know."
"They think I don't care any more. You can observe without passion, bastards. No, I didn't mean that, Slothrop. We're all such mechanical men doing our jobs. That's all we are. Listen, how do you think I feel when you're off with her after every lesson? I'm an impotent man. All I have to look forward to is a book, Slothrop, a report to write."
"Hey, Ace,
don't get angry. I'm harmless. Go ahead, hit me. I'll only fall over and bounce right up again. Watch."
He demonstrates.
"I care about you, both of you. I do care, believe me, Slothrop."
"Okay, tell me what's going on."
"I care."
"Fine, fine.
My function is to observe you. That's my function. You like my function? You like it? Your function is learn the rocket inch by inch. I have to send in a daily log of your progress, and that's all I know."
But that's not all. He's holding something back, something deep. And fool, Slothrop is too drunk to get at it with any kind of style. "Me and Katya, too? You looking through the keyhole?" Sniffling.
"What difference does it make? I'm the perfect man for it, perfect. I can't even masturbate half the time. No nasty jism getting all over their reports, you know. Wouldn't want that. Just a neuter, just a recording eye. They're so cruel.
I don't think they even know, really. They aren't even sadists. There's just no passion at all. Slothra puts a hand on his shoulder.
The suit padding shifts and bunches over the warm bone beneath it. He doesn't know what to say, what to do. Himself, he feels empty and wants to sleep. But Sir Stephen is on his knees, just about quaking at the edge of it, to tell Slothrop a terrible secret, a fatal confidence concerning the penis he thought was his own. Lead tenor.
'Twas the penis he thought was his own, just a big playful boy of a bone, with a stout purple head sticking up from the bed, where the girlies all play telephone. Bass. Telephone.
Inner voices. But they came through the hole in the night. Bass. And they sweet-talked it clear out of sight. Inner voices.
Out of sight.
Tenor.
Now he sighs all alone, with a heartbroken moan, for the penis he thought was his own.
Inner voices.
Was his own.
The figures out to sea have been attending, growing now even more windy and remote as the light goes cold and out. They are so difficult to reach across to, difficult to grasp. Carol Evantier, trying to confirm the Lübeck Angel, learned how difficult. He and his control, Peter Saxa, both floundering in the swamp between the worlds. Later on in London came the visit from that most ubiquitous of double agents, Sammy Hilbert Space, whom everyone had thought in Stockholm, or was at Paraguay. Here, then, the kindly scumbroid face scanning Evantier quick as a fire-controlled dish antenna and even less mercy. I thought I'd...
You thought you'd just check in.
Telepathic, too. God, he's amazing, isn't he? But the fishy eyes will not let up. It is a rather bare room, the address behind Gallaho Mews, ordinarily reserved for cash transactions. They have summoned Evantier up from the White Visitation. They know in London how to draw pentacles, too, and cry conjurations, how to bring in exactly the ones they want. The tabletop is crowded with glasses, smudged, whitish, emptied, or with residues of deep brown and red drinks, with ashtrays and with debris from artificial flowers, which old Sammy here has been plucking, unpeeling, twisting into mysterious curves and knots. Train smoke blows in a partly opened window. One wall of the room, though blank, has been eroded at over years by shadows of operatives, as certain mirrors in public easing places have been by the images of customers, a surface-gathering character like an old face. But then you don't actually talk to him. Ah, Sammy's so good at this, softly, softly. I mean, it's none of your telegraphers in the middle of the night having a bit of a chat sort of thing. No, no. Evantier understanding now that they've been seeing transcripts of everything that comes through from Peter Saxa, that what Evantier himself gets to read is already censored, and that it may have been this way for a while now. So relax, grow passive, watch for a shape to develop out of Sammy's talking, a shape that really Evantier knows already, as we do working out acrostics. He's called up to London, but they aren't asking to be put in touch with anyone, so it's Saxa himself they're interested in, and the purpose of this meeting is not to commission Evantier, but to warn him. To put a part of his own hidden life under interdiction. Bits, tones of voice, choices of phrasing now come flying together. Must have been quite a shock to find himself over there. Had a Saxa or two of me own to worry about. Keep you out of the street, at least. See how you're holding up, old Saxa, too, of course. Need to filter out personalities, you see, from the data. Easier for us that way. Out of the street. Everyone knows how Saxa died. But no one knows why he was out there that day. What led up to it. And what Sammy is telling Evantier here is, don't ask. Then will they try to get to Nora, too? If there are analogies here, if Evantier does, somehow, map on to Peter Saxa, then does Nora Dotson-Truck become the woman Saxa loved, Lainey Perkler? Will the interdiction extend to Nora's smoky voice and steady hands, and is Evantier to be kept, for the duration, perhaps for his life, under some very sophisticated form of house arrest, for crimes that will never be told him? Nora still carries on her adventure, her ideology of the zero, firm among the stone-swept hair of the last white guardians at the last step off into the black, into the radiant. But where will Lainey be now? Where will she have wandered off to, carrying her child,
and her dreams that will not grow up. Either we didn't mean to lose her, either it was an ellipsis in our care, in what some of us will even swear is our love, or someone has taken her, deliberately, for reasons being kept secret. And Saksa's death is part of it, too. She has swept with her wings another life, not husband Franz, who dreamed of, prayed for exactly such a taking, but instead is being kept for something quite different. Peter Saksa, who was passive in a different way, is there some mistake? Do they never make mistakes, or why is he here rushing with her toward her own end? As indeed Evantyr has been sucked along in Nora's furious wake, her body blocking from his sight everything that lies ahead. The slender girl, strangely grown oaken, broad, maternal, all he has to go by is the debris of their time sweeping in behind from either side, looping away in long helices into the dusty invisible where a last bit of sunlight lies on the stones of the road. Yes, however ridiculously, he is acting out Franz Perkler's fantasy for him, here crouched on her back, very small, being taken forward into an ether wind whose smell, no, not that smell, last encountered just before his birth, the void long before he ought to be remembering, which means, if it's here again, then... They are being pushed backward by a line of police. Peter Saksa is jammed inside it, trying to keep his footing, no escape possible. Laney's face moving, restless, against the window of the Hamburg Flyer, concrete roads, pedestals, industrial towers of the Mark flying away at over 100 miles an hour, the perfect background. Brown, blurred, any least mistake in the points in the roadbed at this speed and they're done for. Her skirt is pulled up and back, the bare bottoms of her thighs marked red from the train seat, turned toward him, yes, in the imminence of disaster, yes, whoever's watching, yes. Laney, where are you? She was at his elbow not 10 seconds ago. They'd agreed beforehand to try and keep together. But there are two sorts of movement out here, as often as the chance displacements of strangers across a clear skirmish line from the force will bring together people who will remain that way for a time, in love that can even make the oppression seem a failure. So, too, love, here in the street, can be taken centrifugally apart again. Faces seen for the last time here. Words spoken idly over your shoulder, taking for granted she's there, already last words. Will Walter be bringing wine tonight? I forgot to. It's a private joke. His forgetting, going around in some adolescent confusion, hopelessly in love, too, by now, with the little girl. She is his refuge from society, parties, clients. Often she is his sanity. He's taken to sitting for a little while each night beside her bed, late at night, watching her sleep with her bottom up in the air and face in the pillow. The purity, the rightness of it. But her mother, in her own sleep, grinds her teeth often these nights, frowns, talks in a tongue he cannot admit he might some time or place know and speak fluently. Just in this past week, what does he know of politics? But he can see that she has crossed a threshold, found a branching of the time, where he might not be able to follow. You're her mother. What if they arrest you? What happens to her? That's what they... Peter, can't you see they want a great swollen tit with some atrophied excuse for a human bleeding around somewhere in its shadows? How can I be human for her, not her mother? Mother, that's a civil service category. Mothers work for them. They're the policemen of the soul. Her face darkened, Judaized by the words she speaks, not because it's out loud, but because she means it, and she's right. Against her faith, Saksa can see the shallows of his own life, the bathtub stagnancy of those soirees where for years not even the faces changed, too many tepid years. But I love you. She brushes hair back from his sweating forehead. They lie beneath a window, through which street and advertising light blow constantly, lapping at their skins, at their roundings and shadows, with spectra colder than those of the astrologer's moon. You don't have to be anything you aren't, Peter. I wouldn't be here if I didn't love who you are. Did she goad him into the street? Was she the death of him? In his view from the other side, no. In love, words can be taken too many ways, that's all. But he does feel he was sent across for some particular reason. And Ilse, vamping him with her dark eyes. She can say his name, but often to flirt with him she won't, or she'll call him Mama. No, no, that's Mama. I'm Peter. Remember Peter? Mama. Laney only gazes, a smile held between her lips, almost, he must say, smug, allowing the mix-up in names to fall, to set up male reverberations she can't be ignorant of. If she doesn't want him out in the street, why does she only keep her silence at such moments?
I was only glad she wasn't calling me, Mama,
Lainey thought she'd explain, but that's too close to ideology. It's nothing he can be comfortable with yet. He doesn't know how to listen to talk like that as more than slogans strung together. Hasn't learned to hear with a revolutionary heart, won't ever, in fact, be given enough time to gather a revolutionary heart from the bleak, comradely love of the others. No, no time for it now, or for anything but one more breath, the rough breath of a man growing afraid in the street. Not even enough time to lose his fear in the time-honored way, no, because here comes Schutzmann Jöche, truncheon already in backswing, the section of communist head moving into view for him, stupidly, so unaware of him and his power, the Schutzmann's first clear shot all day. Oh, his timing is perfect. He feels it in arm and out the club, no longer flabby at his side, but tensed back now around in a muscular curve at the top of his swing, peak of potential energy, far below that gray vein in the man's temple, frail as parchment, standing out so clear, twitching already with its next-to-last pulse beat, and shit, oh how beautiful. During the night, Sir Stephen vanishes from the casino, but not before telling Slothrop that his erections are of high interest to Fitzmaurice House. Then in the morning, Katja comes storming in, madder than a wet hen, to tell Slothrop that Sir Stephen's gone. Suddenly everybody is telling Slothrop things, and he's barely awake. Rain rattles at the shutters and windows. Monday mornings, upset stomachs, goodbyes. He blinks out at the misted sea, the horizon mantled in gray, palms gleaming in the rain, heavy and wet and very green. It may be that the champagne is still with him. For 10 extraordinary seconds there's nothing in his field but simple love for what he's seeing. Then, perversely aware of it, he turns away back into the room. Time to play with Katya now. Her face is as pale as her hair, a rain witch. Her hat brim makes a chic, creamy green halo around her face.
Well, he's gone, then. Keenness of this order might work to provoke her.
It's too bad. Then again, maybe it's good.
Never mind him. How much do you know, Slothrop?
What's that mean, never mind him? What do? Just throw people away?
Do you want to find out?
He stands twisting his mustache. Tell me about it.
You bastard. You've sabotaged the whole thing with your clever little collegiate drinking game.
What whole thing, Katya?
What did he tell you?
She moves a step closer. Slothrop watches her hands, thinking of army judo instructors he's seen. It occurs to him he's naked, and also, seems to be getting a hard-on here. Look out, Slothrop, and nobody here to note it or speculate why. Sure didn't tell me you knew any of that judo. Must have taught you it in that Holland, huh? Sure, little things, singing in descending childish thirds. Give you away, you know. Ah! Exasperated, she rushes in, aims a chop at his head, which he's able to dodge, goes diving in under her arm, lifts her in a fireman's carry, throws her against the bed, and comes after her. She kicks a sharp heel at his cock, which is what she should have done in the first place. Her timing, in fact, is drastically off all through this, else she would likely be handing Slothrop's ass to him. It may be that she wants her foot to miss, only scraping Slothrop along the leg as he swerves now, grabs her by the hair and twists an arm behind her, pushing her face down on the bed. Her skirt is up over her ass, her thighs squirming underneath him, his penis in terrific erection. Listen, cunt, don't make me lose my temper with you. Got no problems at all hitting women. I'm the Cagney of the French Riviera, so look out.
I'll kill you.
What, and sabotage the whole thing? Katya turns her head and sinks her teeth in his forearm, up near the elbow where the pentothal needles used to go in. Ow, shit! He lets go the arm he's been twisting, pulls down underwear, takes her by one hip and penetrates her from behind, reaching under to pinch nipples, paw at her clitoris, rake his nails along inside her thighs. Mr. Technique here. Not that it matters. They're both ready to come. Katya first, screaming into the pillow, Slothrop a second or two later. He lies on top of her, sweating, taking great breaths, watching her face turned three quarters away. Not even a profile, but the terrible face that is no face. Gone too abstract, unreachable. The notch of eye socket, but never the label eye. Only the anonymous curve of cheek, convexity of mouth, a noseless mask of the other order of being. of Katya's being, the lifeless non-face that is the only face of hers he really knows or will ever remember. "Hey, Katya," is all he says. But here's only her old residual bitterness again. And they are not, after all, to be lovers in parachutes of sunlit voile, lapsing gently hand in hand down to anything meadowed or calm. Surprised? She has moved away, releasing his cock into the cold room.
"What's it like in London, Slothrop, when the rockets come down?"
"What?" After fucking, he usually likes to lie around, just smoke a cigarette, think about food. "You don't know it's there till it's there. See, till after it's there. If it doesn't hit you, then you're okay till the next one. If you hear the explosion, you know you must be alive."
"That's how you know you're alive."
"Right." She sits up, pulling underpants back up and skirt back down, goes to the mirror, starts rearranging her hair. "Let's hear the boundary layer temperatures while you're getting dressed. Boundary layer temperature T sub E, what is this? Rises exponentially till Brennschluss, around 70 miles range, eh? And then there's a sharp cusp, 1200 degrees, then it drops a little, minimum of 1050 till you get out of the atmosphere, then there's another cusp at 1080 degrees. Stays pretty steady till re-entry, blah, blah, blah. The bridge music here, bright with xylophones, is based on some old favorite that will comment ironically but gently on what is transpiring. A tune such as school days, or come, Josephine, in my flying machine, or even there'll be a hot time in the old town tonight. Take your pick, slowing and fading to a glassed-in porch downstairs, Slothrop and Katya tete-a-tete, alone except for a number of musicians in the corner groaning and shaking their heads, plotting how to get Cesar Flebotimo to pay them for a change. Bad gig, bad gig. Rain bats against the glass. Lemon and myrtle trees outside shake in the wind. Over croissants, strawberry jam, real butter, real coffee. She has him running through the flight profile in terms of wall temperature and Nusselt heart transfer coefficients, computing in his head from Reynolds numbers she flashes him, equations of motion, damping, restoring moments, methods of computing Brennschluss by IG and radio methods, equations, transformations. "Now jet expansion angles. I'll give you altitude. You tell me the angle. Katya, why don't you tell me the angle?" She was pleased once to think of a peacock courting, fanning his tail. She saw it in the colors that moved in the flame as it rose off the platform, scarlet, orange, iridescent green. There were Germans, even SS troops, who called the rocket Der Pfau, Pfau II, the sending programmed in a ritual of love. At Brennschluss, it is done. The rocket's purely feminine counterpart, the zero point at the center of its target, has submitted. All the rest will happen according to laws of ballistics. The rocket is helpless in it. Something else has taken over, something beyond what was designed in. Katya has understood the great airless arc as a clear allusion to certain secret lusts that drive the planet and herself and those who use her, over its peak and down, plunging, burning toward a terminal orgasm, which is certainly nothing she can tell Swathrop. They sit listening to gusts of rain that's nearly sleet. Winter gathers, breathes, deepens. A roulette ball goes rattling somewhere back in another room. She's running. Why? Has he come too close again? He tries to remember if she always needed to talk this way, in draw shots, rebounding first before she could touch him. Find time to start asking. He's counter-conspiring in the dark, jimmying doors at random, no telling what'll come out. Dark basalt pushes up out of the sea. A vaporous scrim hangs across the headland and its chateaus, turning it all to a grainy antique postcard. He touches her hand, moves his fingers up her bare arm, reaching. "Come on upstairs," says Slothrop. She may have hesitated, but so briefly that he didn't notice. "What have we been talking about all this time?" "The A4 rocket." He looks at him for a long time. At first he thinks she's about to laugh at him, then it looks like she'll cry. He doesn't understand. "Oh, Slothrop, no, you don't want me. What they're after may, but you don't. No more than A4 wants London, but I don't think they know about other selves, yours or the rockets. No, no more than you do. If you can't understand it now, at least remember. That's all I can do for you." They go back up to her room again. Cock, cunt, the Monday rain at the windows. Slothrop spends the rest of the morning and early afternoon studying Professors Schiller on regenerative cooling, Wagner on combustion equations, Power and Beck on exhaust gases and burning efficiency, and the pornography of blueprints. At noon, the rain stops. Katya is off on chores of her own. Stoffer passes a few hours downstairs in the bar, waiters who catch his eye smiling, holding up bottles of champagne, wiggling them invitingly. No, merci, no. He's trying to memorize the organization chart at that Peenemünde. As light begins to spill from the overcast sky, he and Katya are out taking a walk, an end-of-the-day stroll along the esplanade. Her hand is gloveless and icy in his, her narrow black coat making her taller, her long silences helping to thin her for him nearly to fog. They stop, lean against a railing, he watching the midwinter sea, she the blind and chilly casino poised behind them. Colorless clouds slide by endlessly in the sky. I was thinking of the time I came in on you, that afternoon. He can't quite bring himself to get specific out loud, but she knows he means the Himmler Spielsaal. She has looked around sharply. So was I. Their breaths are torn into phantoms out to sea. She has her hair combed high today in a pompadour, her fair eyebrows plucked to wings, darkened, eyes rimmed in black, only the outboard few lashes missed and left blonde. Cloudlight comes slanting down across her face, taking away color, leaving little more than a formal snapshot, the kind that might appear on a passport. Hey, Anne, you were so far away then, I couldn't reach you. Then, something like pity comes into her face and goes again. But her whisper is lethal and bright as sudden wire. Maybe you'll find out. Maybe in one of their bombed-out cities, beside one of their rivers or forests, even one day in the rain it will come to you. You'll remember the Himmler Spielsaal and the skirt I was wearing. Memory will dance for you, and you can even make it my voice saying what I couldn't say then or now. Oh, what is it she smiles here to him only for that second, already gone. Back to the mask of no luck, no future. Her face is rest state. Preferred, easiest. They are standing among black, curly skeletons of iron benches on the empty curve of this esplanade, banked much more steeply than the waking will ever need. Vertiginous, trying to spill them into the sea and be rid of this. The day has grown colder. Neither of them can stay balanced for long. Every few seconds, one or the other must find a new footing. He reaches and turns up the collar of her coat, holds her cheeks then in his palms. Is he trying to bring back the color of flesh? He looks down, trying to see into her eyes, and is puzzled to find tears coming up to fill each one, soaking in among her lashes, mascara bleeding out in fine black swirls, translucent stones trembling in their sockets. Waves crash and drag at the stones of the beach. The harbor has broken out in whitecaps, so brilliant they can't be gathering their light from this drab sky. Here it is again, that identical-looking other world. Is he going to have this to worry about now? What the... Look at these trees, each long frond hanging, stung, dizzying in a laborious dry point against the sky, each so perfectly placed. She has moved her thighs and the points of her hips up to touch him through her coat. It might still, after all, be to help bring him back, her breath a white scarf, her tear trails winter-lit ice. She feels warm, but it's not enough. Never was. Nope. He understands, all right. She's been meaning to go for a long time. Braced for the wind the whitecaps imply, or for the tilt of the pavement, they hold each other. He kisses her eyes, feels his cock again begin to swell with a good old, bad old, old anyhow, lust. Out at sea, a single clarinet begins to play, a droll melody joined in on after a few bars by guitars and mandolins. Birds huddle bright-eyed on the beach. Katya's heart lightens a little at the sound. Stoffer doesn't yet have the European reflexes to clarinets. He still thinks of Benny Goodman and not of clowns or circuses. But wait, aren't these kazoos coming? Yeah, a lot of kazoos. A kazoo band. Late that night, back in her room, she wears a red gown of heavy silk. Two tall candles burn an indefinite distance behind her. He feels the change. After making love, she lies propped on an elbow, watching him, breathing deep, dark nipples riding with the swell, as boys ride on the white sea. But a patina has formed on her eyes. He can't even see her accustomed retreat this last time, dimmed, graceful, to the corner of some inner room. Katya. breaking dreamy fingernails down the morning over the Côte d'Azur toward Italy. Swelthrop wants to sing, decides to, but then can't think of anything that'd work. He reaches an arm without wetting his fingers, snuffs the candles. She kisses the pain. It hurts even more. He falls asleep in her arms. When he wakes, she is gone, completely. Most of her never-worn clothes still in the closet. Blisters and a little wax on his fingers, and one cigarette stubbed out before its time in an exasperated fishhook. She never wasted cigarettes. She must have sat, smoking, watching him while he slept. Until something... He'll never be asking her what triggered her, made it impossible to stay till cigarettes end. He straightens it out, finishes it. No point wasting smokes, is there, with a war on? Ordinarily, in our behavior, we react not singly but complexly to fit the ever-present contents of our environment. In old people, Pavlov was lecturing at the age of 83, that matter is altogether different. Concentrating on one stimulus, we exclude by negative induction other collateral and simultaneous stimuli because they often do not suit the circumstances, are not complementary reactions in the given setting. Thus, Pointsman never shows these excursions of his to anyone, reaching for some flower on my table. I know the cool mosaic of my room begin its slow inhibitory dissolve around the bloom, the stimulus, the need that brighter burns as brightness quickly sucked from objects all around now concentrates, yet less than blinding, focuses to flame. Whilst there yet, in the room's hypnotic evening, the others lurk. The books, the instruments, the old man's clothes, an old Gorodsky stick, glazed now but with their presences, their spirits or memories I kept of where they were, are cancelled for this moment by the flame. The reach toward the frail and waiting flower, and so one of them, pen or empty glass, is knocked from where it was, perhaps to roll beyond the blank frontiers of memory. Yet this, be clear, is no senile distraction, but concentrating, such as younger men can easily and laughing dodge, their world presenting too much more than one mean loss. And out here, 83, the cortex slacked, excitatory processes eased to cinders by inhibitions tweaking calloused fingers. Each time my room begins its blur, I feel I've looked in on some city's practice blackout, such as must come should Germany keep on that road of madness. Each light winking out, except at last for one bright, stubborn bloom the wardens cannot quench, or not this time. The weekly briefings at the White Visitation are all but abandoned. Hardly anyone sees the old brigadier about these days. There is evidence of a budgetary insecurity begun to filter in among the cherub-crusted halls and nooks of the Pisces facility. "The old man's funking," cries Myron Grunton, none too stable himself these days. The Slothrop group are gathered for their regular meeting in the ARF wing. "He'll shoot down the whole scheme. All it'll take is one bad night." A degree of well-bred panic can be observed among those present. In the background, laboratory assistants move about cleaning up dog shit and calibrating instruments. Rats and mice, white and black, and a few shades of gray run clattering on their wheels in 100 cages. Pointsman is the only one here maintaining his calm. He appears unruffled and strong. His lab coats have even begun lately to take on a Savile Row serenity, suppressed waist, flaring vents, finer material, rather rakishly notched lapels. In this parched and fallow time, he gushes affluence. After the baying has quieted down at last, he speaks, soothing, "There's no danger." "No danger?" screams Aaron Throster, and a lot of them are off again, muttering and growling. "Slothrop's knocked out Dotson truck and the girl in one day. The whole thing's falling apart, Pointsman. Since Sir Stephen came back, Fitzmaurice House has dropped out of the scheme, and there's been embarrassing inquiries down from Duncan Sands." "That's the PM's son-in-law, Pointsman. Not good, not good. We've already begun to run into a deficit. Funding, if you can keep your head, is available, and will be coming in before long, certainly before we run into any serious trouble. Sir Stephen, far from being knocked out, is quite happily at work in Fitzmaurice House and is at home there should any of you wish to confirm. Miss Borgesius is still active on the program, and Mr. Duncan Sands is having all his questions answered. But best of all, we are budgeted well into fiscal 46 before anything like a deficit begins to rear its head. Your interested parties again? Says Rollo Grost. I noticed Clive Mossmoon from Imperial Chemicals closeted with you day before yesterday, Edwin Treacle mentions now. Clive and I took an organic chemistry course or two together back at Manchester. Is ICI one of our, sponsors, pointsman? No, smoothly. Mossmoon actually is working out of Mallet Street these days. I'm afraid we were up to nothing more sinister than a bit of routine coordination over the Schwartz Commando business. The hell you were, I happen to know, Clive, that ICI managing some sort of polymer research. They stare at each other. One is lying, or bluffing, or both are, or all of the above. But whatever it is, Pointsman has a slight advantage. By facing squarely the extinction of his program, he has gained a great bit of wisdom, that if there is a life force operating in nature, still there is nothing so analogous in a bureaucracy, nothing so mystical. It all comes down, as it must, to the desires of individual men. Oh, and women, too, of course, bless their empty little heads. But survival depends on having strong enough desires, on knowing the system better than the other chap, and how to use it. It's work, that's all it is, and there's no room for any extra-human anxieties. They only weaken, effeminize the will. A man either indulges them or fights to win, und so weiter. I do wish ICI would finance part of this, Pointsman smiles. Lame, lame, mutters the younger Dr. Grost. What's it matter, cries Aaron Throster, if the old man gets moody at the wrong time, this whole show can prang. Brigadier Pudding will not go back on any of his commitments, Pointsman very steady, calm. We have made arrangements with him. The details aren't important. They never are, in these meetings of his. Treacle has been comfortably sidetracked onto the Moss Moon issue. Rollo Grost's carping asides never get as far as serious opposition and are useful in presenting the appearance of open discussion, as are Throster's episodes of hysteria for distracting the others. So the gathering breaks up, the conspirators head off for coffee, wives, whiskey, sleep, indifference. Webley Silvernail stays behind to secure his audiovisual gear and loot the ashtrays. Dog Vanya, back for the moment in an ordinary state of mind, if not of kidneys, which are vulnerable after a while to bromide therapy, has been allowed a short break from the test stand, and he goes sniffing now over to the cage of rat Ilya. Ilya puts his muzzle against the galvanized wire, and the two paws this way, nose to nose, life and life. Silvernail, puffing on a hook-shaped stub, lugging a 16mm projector, leaves ARF by way of a long row of cages, exercise wheels strobing under the fluorescent lights. Careful news, guys, here comes the screw. Oh, he's okay, Louis. He's a regular guy. The others laugh. Then what's he doing in here, huh? The long white lights buzz overhead. Gray-smocked assistants chat, smoke, linger at various routines. Look out, Lefty, they're coming for you this time. Watch this, chuckles Mouse Alexei. When he picks me up, I'm gonna shit right in his hand. Better not, hey, you know what happened to Slug, don't you? They fried him when he did that, man. The first time he fucked up running that maze, 100 volts. They said it was a accident. Yeah, sure it was. From overhead, from a German camera angle, it occurs to Webley Silvernail this lab here is also a maze. Isn't it now? Behaviorists run these aisles of tables and consoles just like rats and mice. Reinforcement for them is not a pellet of food, but a successful experiment. But who watches from above? Who notes their responses? Who hears the small animals in the cages as they mate or nurse or communicate through the gray quadrilles or, as now, begin to sing, come out of their enclosures, in fact, grown to Webley Silvernail size, though none of the lab people seem to be noticing, to dance him down the long aisles and metal apparatus with conga drums and a peppy tropical orchestra taking up the very popular beat and melody of Pavlovia, Beguine. It was spring in Pavlovia, I was lost in a maze. Lysol breezes perfumed the air, I'd been searching for days. I found you in a cul-de-sac, as bewildered as I. We touched noses, and suddenly my heart learned how to fly. So together we found our way, shared a pellet or two, like an evening in some cafe, wanting nothing but you. Autumn's come to Pavlovia, once again I'm alone, finding sorrow by millivolts back to neurons and bone. And I think of our moments then, never knowing your name. Nothing's left in Pavlovia but the maze and the game. They dance in flowing skeins. The rats and mice form circles, curl their tails in and out to make chrysanthemum and sunburst patterns, eventually all form into the shape of a single giant mouse at whose eye Silvernail poses with a smile, arms up in a V, sustaining the last note of the song along with the giant rodent chorus and orchestra. One of PWD's classic propaganda leaflets these days urges the Volksgrenadier Setzt V2 ein, with a footnote explaining that V2 means to raise both arms in honorable surrender, more gallows humor, and telling how to say phonetically, I surrender. Is Webley's V here for victory or surrender? They have had their moment of freedom. Webley has only been a guest star. Now it's back to the cages and the rationalized forms of death, death in the service of the one species cursed with the knowledge that it will die. I would set you free if I knew how, but it isn't free out here. All the animals, the plants, the minerals, even other kinds of men are being broken and reassembled every day to preserve an elite few who are the loudest to theorize on freedom, but the least free of all. I can't even give you hope that it will be different someday, that they'll come out and forget death and lose their technology's elaborate terror and stop using every other form of life without mercy to keep what haunts men down to a tolerable level and be like you instead, simply here, simply alive. The guest star retires down the corridors. Lights, all but a sprinkling, are out at the White Visitation. The sky tonight is deep blue, blue as a navy greatcoat, and the clouds in it are amazingly white. The wind is keen and cold. Old Brigadier Pudding, trembling, slips from his quarters down the back stairs by a route only he knows, through the vacant orangery in the starlight, along a gallery hung to lace dandies, horses, ladies with hard-boiled eggs for eyes, out a small entresol, point of maximum danger, and into a lumber room whose stacks of junk and random blacknesses, even this far from his childhood, are good for a chill. Out again and down a set of metal steps, singing, he hopes quietly for courage. Wash me in the water that you wash your dirty daughter, and I shall be whiter than the whitewash on the wall. At last to D-Wing, where the madmen of the 30s persist. The night attendant is asleep under the Daily Herald. He is a coarse-looking fellow and has been reading the leader. It is an indication of things to come. Next election? Oh, dear. But orders are to let the brigadier pass. The old man tiptoes by, breathing fast. Mucus rattles back in his throat. He's at the age where mucus is a daily companion, a culture of mucus among the old, mucus in a thousand manifestations appearing in clots by total surprise on a friend's tablecloth, rimming his breath passages at night in hard venturi, enough to darken the outlines of dreams and send him awake, pleading. A voice from some cell too distant for us to locate intones, I am blessed Metatron. I am keeper of the secret. I am guardian of the throne. And here the more disturbing wig excesses have been chiseled away or painted over, no point disturbing the inmates. All is neutral tones, soft draperies, impressionist prints on the walls. Only the marble floor has been left, and under the bulbs it gleams like water. Old Pudding must negotiate half a dozen offices or anterooms before reaching his destination. It hasn't yet been a fortnight, but there is already something of ritual to this, of iteration. Each room will hold a single unpleasantness for him, a test he must pass. He wonders if Pointsman hasn't set these up, too. Of course he must. How did the young bastard ever find out? Have I been talking him asleep? Have they been slipping in at night with their truth serums to... And just at the clear emergence of the thought, here is his first test tonight. In the first room, a hypodermic outfit has been left lying on a table, very clear and shining, with the rest of the room slightly out of focus. Yes, mornings I felt terribly groggy, couldn't wake after dreaming. Were they dreams? I was talking, but it's all he remembers, talking while someone else was there listening. He is shivering with fear, and his face is whiter than whitewash. In the second antechamber is an empty red tin that held coffee. The brand name is Savarin. He understands that it means to say Severin. Oh, the filthy, the mocking scoundrel. But these are not malignant puns against an intended sufferer so much as a sympathetic magic, a repetition high and low of some prevailing form, as, for instance, no sane demolition man at his evening dishwater will wash a spoon between two cups or even between a glass and a plate for fear of the trembler it implies. Because it's a trembler tongue he really holds, poised between its two fatal contacts, in fingers aching with having been so suddenly reminded. In the third, a file drawer is left ajar, a stack of case histories partly visible, and an open copy of Kraft Ebbing. In the fourth, a human skull. His excitement grows. In the fifth, a Malacca cane. I've been in more wars for England than I can remember. Haven't I paid enough? Risked it all for them time after time? Why must they torment an old man? In the sixth chamber, hanging from the overhead, is a tattered Tommy up on White Sheet Ridge. Field uniform burned in Maxim holes, black-rimmed as the eyes of Cléo de Mérode. His own left eye shot away. The corpse beginning to stink. No, no, an overcoat, someone's old coat, that's all left on a hook in the wall. But couldn't he smell it? Now mustard gas comes washing in, into his brain with a fatal buzz as dreams will when we don't want them, or when we are suffocating. A machine gun on the German side sings dum-di-di-da-da, an English weapon answers dum-dum, and the night tightens coiling round his body just before H hour. At the seventh cell, his knuckles feeble against the dark oak, he knocks. The lock, remotely, electrically commanded, slams open with an edge of echo trailing. He enters and closes the door behind him. The cell is in semi-darkness, with only a scented candle burning back in a corner that seems miles away. She waits for him in a tall Adam chair, white body and black uniform of the night. He drops to his knees. Domina Nocturna, shining mother and last love, your servant Ernest Pudding reporting as ordered. In these war years, the focus of a woman's face is her mouth. Lipstick among these tough and too often shallow girls prevails like blood. Eyes have been left to weather and to tears. These days, with so much death hidden in the sky, out under the sea, among the blobs and smears of retro photographs, most women's eyes are only functional. But Pudding comes out of a different time, and Pointsman has considered this detail, too. The brigadier's lady has spent an hour at her vanity mirror with mascara, liner, shadow, and pencil, lotions and rouges, brushes and tweezers, consulting from time to time a loose-leaf album filled with photographs of the reigning beauties of 30 and 40 years ago, so that her reign these nights may be authentic. If not, it is for her state of mind as well as his, legitimate. Her blonde hair is tucked and pinned beneath a thick wig. When she sits with her head down, forgetting the regal posture, the hair comes forward over her shoulders below her breasts. She is naked now, except for a long sable cape and black boots with court heels. Her only jewelry is a silver ring with an artificial ruby not cut to facets but still in the original boule, an arrogant gout of blood extended now, waiting his kiss. His clipped mustache bristles, trembling across her fingers. She has filed her nails to long points and polished them the same red as her ruby. Their ruby. In this light, the nails are almost black. That's enough. Get ready. She watches him undress, medals faintly jingling, starch shirt rattling. She wants a cigarette desperately, but her instructions are not to smoke. He tries to keep her hand still. What are you thinking, Pudding? Of the night we first met. The mud stank. The Archies were chugging in the darkness. His men, his poor sheep, had taken gas that morning. He was alone. Through the periscope, underneath a star shell that hung in the sky, he saw her, and though he was hidden, she saw Pudding. Her face was pale. She was dressed all in black. She stood in no man's land. The machine guns raked their patterns all around her, but she needed no protection. They knew you, mistress. They were your own. And so were you. You called to me. You said, I shall never leave you. You belong to me. We shall be together again and again, though it may be years between, and you will always be at my service. He is on his knees again, bare as a baby.
His old man's flesh creeps coarse-grained in the light from the candle. Old scars and new welts group here and there over his skin. His penis stands at present arms. She smiles. At her command, he crawls forward to kiss her boots. He smells wax and leather and can feel her toes flexing beneath his tongue through the black skin. From the corner of his eye on a little table, he can see the remains of her early evening meal, the edge of a plate, the tops of two bottles, mineral water, French wine. Time for pain now, Brigadier. You shall have 12 of the best, if your offering tonight pleases me. Here is his worst moment. She has refused him before. His memories of the salient do not interest her. She doesn't seem to care for mass slaughter as much as for myth and personal terror, but please, please let her accept. Et Badajoz, whispering humbly, during the war in Spain, the bandera of Franco's legion advanced on the city singing their regimental hymn. They sang of the bride they had taken. It was you, mistress. They were proclaiming you as their bride. She's silent for a bit, making him wait. At last, eyes holding his, she smiles, the component of evil in it she has found he needs, taking care of itself as usual.
Yes, many of them did become my bridegrooms that day, she whispers, flexing the bright cane.
There seems to be a winter wind in the room. Her image threatens to shake apart into separate flakes of snow. He loves to listen to her speak. Hers is the voice that found him from the broken rooms of the Flemish villages he knows. He can tell from the accent the girls who grew old in the Low Countries, whose voices went corrupted from young to old, gay to indifferent, as that war drew out, season into ever more bitter season.
I took their brown Spanish bodies to mine. They were the color of the dust and the twilight and of meats roasted to a perfect texture. Most of them were so very young. A summer day, a day of love, one of the most poignant I ever knew. Thank you. You shall have your pain tonight.
It's a part of her routine she can enjoy, at least. Though she has never read any classic British pornography, she does feel herself, sure as a fish, well in the local mainstream. Six on the buttocks, six more across the nipples. Whack! Where's that gourd surprise now, eh? She likes the way the blood leaps to cross last night's welts. Often it's all she can do to keep from moaning herself at each of his grunts of pain, two voices in a dissonance which would be much less accidental than it sounded. Some nights she's gagged him with a ceremonial sash, bound him with a gold-tasseled fourragère or his own Sam Brown. But tonight he lies humped in the floor at her feet, his withered ass elevated for the cane, bound by nothing but his need for pain, for something real, something pure. They have taken him so far from his simple nerves. They have stuffed paper illusions and military euphemisms between him and this truth, this rare decency, this moment at her scrupulous feet. No, it's not guilt here, not so much as amazement, that he could have listened to so many years of ministers, scientists, doctors, each with his specialized lies to tell, when she was here all the time, sure in her ownership of his failing body, his true body, undisguised by uniform, uncluttered by drugs to keep from him her communiques of vertigo, nausea, and pain, above all, pain, the clearest poetry, the endearment of greatest worth. He struggles to his knees to kiss the instrument. She stands over him now, legs astride, pelvis cocked forward, fur cape held apart on her hips. He dares to gaze up at her cunt, that fearful vortex. Her pubic hair has been dyed black for the occasion. He sighs and lets escape a small, shameful groan.
Ah, yes, I know, she laughs. Poor mortal Brigadier, I know it is my last mystery.
Stroking with fingernails her labia,
you cannot ask a woman to reveal her last mystery, now can you? Please. No, not tonight. Kneel here and take what I give you.
Despite himself, already a reflex, he glances quickly over at the bottles on the table, the plates, soiled with juices of meat, hollandaise, bits of gristle and bone. Her shadow covers his face and upper torso. Her leather boots creak softly as thigh and abdominal muscles move, and then, in a rush, she begins to piss.
He opens his mouth to catch the stream, choking, trying to keep swallowing, feeling warm urine dribble out the corners of his mouth and down his neck and shoulders, submerged in the hissing storm. When she's done, he licks the last few drops from his lips. More cling, golden clear, to the glossy hairs of her quim. Her face, looming between her bare breasts, is smooth as steel. She turns.
Hold up my fur.
He obeys.
Be careful. Don't touch my skin.
Earlier in this game, she was nervous, constipated, wondering if this was anything like male impotence. But thoughtful pointsman, anticipating this, has been sending laxative pills with her meals. Now her intestines whine softly, and she feels shit begin to slide down and out. He kneels with his arms up, holding the rich cape. A dark turd appears out the crevice, out of the absolute darkness between her white buttocks. He spreads his knees awkwardly until he can feel the leather of her boots. He leans forward to surround the hot turd with his lips, sucking on it, tenderly licking along its lower side. He is thinking he's sorry. He can't help it, thinking of a Negro's penis. Yes, he knows it abrogates part of the conditions set, but it will not be denied. The image of a brute African who will make him behave. The stink of shit floods his nose, gathering him, surrounding. It is the smell of Pasandala, of the salient. Mixed with the mud and the putrefaction of corpses, it was the sovereign smell of their first meeting and her emblem. The turd slides into his mouth, down to his gullet. He gags, but bravely clamps his teeth shut. Bread that would only have floated in porcelain waters somewhere, unseen, untasted, risen now and baked in the bitter intestinal oven to bread we know, bread that's light as domestic comfort, secret as death in bed. Spasms in his throat continue. The pain is terrible. With his tongue he mashes shit against the roof of his mouth and begins to chew thickly now, the only sound in the room. There are two more turds, smaller ones, and when he has eaten these, residual shit to lick out of her anus. He prays that she'll let him drop the cape over himself to be allowed, in the silk-lined darkness, to stay a while longer with his submissive tongue straining upward into her asshole. But she moves away. The fur evaporates from his hands. She orders him to masturbate for her. She has watched Captain Blissera with Gottfried and has learned the proper style. The brigadier comes quickly. The rich smell of semen fills the room like smoke.
Now go.
He wants to cry, but he has pleaded before, offered her, absurdly, his life. Tears well and slide from his eyes. He can't look into hers.
You have shit all over your mouth now. Perhaps I'll take a photograph of you like that in case you ever get tired of me.
No, no, I'm only tired of that, jerking his head back out of D-wing to encompass the rest of the white visitation. So bloody tired.
Get dressed. Remember to wipe your mouth off. I'll send for you when I want you again.
Dismissed. Back in uniform, he closes the cell door and retraces his way in. The night attendant is still asleep. Cold air hits pudding like a blow. He sobs, bent, alone, cheek resting a moment against the rough stone walls of the Palladian house. His regular quarters have become a place of exile, and his real home is with the mistress of the night, with her soft boots and hard foreign voice. He has nothing to look forward to but a late-night cup of broth, routine papers to sign, a dose of penicillin that Pointsman has ordered him to take to combat the effects of E. coli. Perhaps, though tomorrow night, perhaps then. He can't see how he can hold out much longer. But perhaps, in the hours just before dawn. The great cusp, green equinox and turning, dreaming fishes to young ram, water sleep to fire waking, bears down on us. Across the western front, up in the Harz in Bleicherode, Werner von Braun, lately wrecked arm in a plaster cast, prepares to celebrate his 33rd birthday. Artillery thunders through the afternoon. Russian tanks raise dust phantoms far away over the German lees. The storks are home, and the first violets have appeared. At the white visitation, days along the chalk piece of seacoast now are fine and clear. The office girls are bundling into fewer sweaters and breasts peeking through into visibility again. March has come in like a lamb. Lloyd George is dying. Stray visitors are observed now along the still-forbidden beach, sitting among obsolescent networks of steel rod and cable, trousers rolled to the knee or hair unsnooded, chilly gray toes stirring the shingle. Just offshore, underwater, run miles of secret piping, oil ready at a valve twist, to be released and roast German invaders who belong back in dreams already old, fuel waiting, hypergolic ignition that will not come unless now as some junior bureaucratic rag or May uprising of the spirit, to Bavarian tunesmith Karl Orff's lively O totus florio, jam amore virginali totus adeo. All this fortress coast alight, Portsmouth to Dungeness blazing for the love of spring. Plots to this effect hatch daily among the livelier heads at the White Visitation. The winter of dogs, of black snowfalls, of issueless words is ending. Soon it will be behind us. But once there, behind us, will it still go on emanating its hooded cold, however the fires burn at sea? At the Casino Hermann Göring, a new regime has been taking over. General Wyverns is now the only familiar face, though he seems to have been downgraded. Slothrop's own image of the plot against him has grown. Earlier, the conspiracy was monolithic, all-potent, nothing he could ever touch. Until that drinking game and that scene with that Katya and both the sudden goodbyes, but now... Proverbs for paranoids. 1. You may never get to touch the master, but you can tickle his creatures. And then, well, he is lately beginning to find his way into one particular state of consciousness, not a dream, certainly, perhaps what used to be called a reverie, though one where the colors are more primaries than pastels. And at such times it seems he has touched and stayed touching for a while a soul we know, a voice that has more than once spoken through research facility medium Carol Eventier, the late Roland Feldspath again, long co-opted expert on control systems, guidance equations, feedback situations for this aeronautical establishment and that. Seems that for personal reasons, Roland has remained hovering over this Slothropian space through sunlight whose energy he barely feels and through storms that tickled his back with static electricity, has Roland been whispering from 8 kilometers, the savage height, stationed as he has been along one of the last parabolas, flight paths that must never be taken, working as one of the invisible interdictors of the stratosphere now. Bureaucratized hopelessly on that side as ever on this, he keeps his astral meat hooks in as well as can be expected, curled in the sky, so tense with all the frustrations of trying to reach across with the impotence of certain dreamers who try to wake or talk and cannot, who struggle against weights and probes of cranial pain that it seems could not be borne waking. He waits not necessarily for the aimless entrance of boobs like Slothrop here. Roland shivers. Is this the one? This? To be figurehead for the latest passage? Oh, dear, God have mercy. What storms, what monsters of the ether could this Slothrop ever charm away for anyone? Well, Roland must make the best of it, that's all. If they get this far, he has to show them what he knows about control. That's one of his death's secret missions. His cryptic utterances that night at Snoxall's about economic systems are merely the folksy everyday background chatter over here, a given condition of being. Ask the Germans especially. Oh, it is a real sad story. How shoddily their Schwärmerei for control was used by the folks in power. Paranoid Systems of History, PSH, a short-lived periodical of the 1920s whose plates have all mysteriously vanished, Netsch has even suggested in more than one editorial that the whole German inflation was created deliberately, simply to drive young enthusiasts of the cybernetic tradition into control work. After all, an economy inflating, upward bound as a balloon, its own definition of Earth's surface drifting upward in value, uncontrolled, drifting with the days, the feedback system expected to maintain the value of the mark constant, having humiliatingly failed. Unity gain around the loop, unity gain, zero change, and hush, that way, forever, these were the secret rhymes of the childhood of the discipline of control. Secret and terrible, as the Scarlet Histories say. Diverging oscillations of any kind were nearly the worst threat. You could not pump the swings of these playgrounds higher than a certain angle from the vertical. Fights broke up quickly, with a smoothness that had not been long in coming. Rainy days never had much lightning or thunder to them, only a haughty glass grayness collecting in the lower parts. a monochrome overlook of valleys crammed with mossy deadfalls, jabbing roots at heaven, not entirely in malign playfulness, as some white surprise for the elitists up there paying no mind, no. Valleys thick with autumn, and in the rain, a withering, spinsterish brown behind the gold of it. Very selectively blighted rainfall teasing you across the lots and into the back streets, which grow ever more mysterious and badly paved and more deeply platted, lot giving way to crooked lot 7 times and often more around angles of hedge, across freaks of the optical daytime until we have passed, fevered, silent, out of the region of streets itself, and into the countryside, into the quilted, dark fields and the wood, the beginning of the true forest, where a bit of the ordeal ahead starts to show, and our hearts to feel afraid. But just as no swing could ever be thrust above a certain height, so, beyond a certain radius, the forest could be penetrated no further. A limit was always there to be brought to. It was so easy to grow up under that dispensation. All was just as wholesome as could be. Edges were hardly ever glimpsed, much less flirted at or with. Destruction, oh, and demons, yes, including Maxwell's, were there deep in the woods with other beasts vaulting among the earthworks of your safety. So was the rocket's terrible passage reduced, literally, to bourgeois terms. Terms of an equation such as that elegant blend of philosophy and hardware, abstract change and hinged pivots of real metals which describes motion under the aspect of your control. Theta times d square phi dt square plus delta asterisk d phi dt plus partial derivative of L over partial derivative of alpha times s sub 1 minus s sub 2 times alpha equals minus partial derivative of R over partial derivative of beta times S sub 3 times beta. Preserving, possessing, steering between Scylla and Charybdis the whole way to Brenchlus. If any of the young engineers saw correspondence between the deep conservatism of feedback and the kinds of lives they were coming to lead in the very process of embracing it, it got lost or disguised. None of them made the connection, at least not while alive. It took death to show it to Roland Feldspath, death with its very good chances for being too late, and a host of other souls feeling themselves, even now, rocket-like, driving out toward the stone-blue lights of the vacuum under a control they cannot claim. The illumination out here is surprisingly mild. Mild as heavenly robes, a feeling of population and invisible force, fragments of voices, glimpses into another order of being. Afterwards, Slothrop would be left not so much with any clear symbol or scheme to it as with some alkaline aftertaste of lament, an irreducible strangeness, a self-sufficiency nothing could get inside. Yes, sort of German, these episodes here. Well, these days, Slothrop is even dreaming in the language. Folks have been teaching him dialects, Plattdeutsch for the zone the British plan to occupy, Thuringian, if the Russians happen not to drive as far as Nordhausen, where the central rocket works is located. Along with the language teachers come experts in ordnance, electronics, and aerodynamics, and a fellow from Shell International Petroleum named Hilary Bounce, who is going to teach him about propulsion. It seems that early in 1941, the British Ministry of Supply let a £10,000 research contract to Shell. Wanted Shell to develop a rocket engine that would run on something besides cordite, which was being used in those days to blow up various sorts of people at the rate of oodles and oodles of tons an hour, and couldn't be spared for rockets. A team, ramrodded by one Isaac Lubach, set up a static test facility at Langhurst near Horsham and began to experiment with liquid oxygen and aviation fuel, running their first successful test in August of 42. Engineer Lubach was a double first at Cambridge, and the father of British liquid oxygen research, and what he didn't know about the sour stuff wasn't worth knowing. His chief assistant these days is Mr. Geoffrey Gollan, and it is to Gollan that Hilary Bounce reports. "Well, I'm an SO man myself," Slothrop thinks he ought to mention. "My old short was a gas gobbler all right, but a gourmet. Any time it used that shell, I had to drop a whole bottle of that bromo in the tank just to settle that poor fucking terraplane's plumbing down."
Actually, the eyebrows of Captain Bounce, a 110% company man, going up and down earnestly to help him out. We handled only the transport and storage end of things then. In those days before the Japs and the Nazis, you know, production and refining were up to the Dutch office at The Hague. Slothrop, poor sap, is remembering Katja. Lost Katja. Saying the name of her city, whispering Dutch love words as they moved down sea mornings, now another age, another dispensation. Wait a minute. That's Batavsche Petroleum, Maatschappij, NV? Right. It's also the negative of a Recco photograph of the city, dark brown, festooned with water spots, never enough time to let these dry out completely. Are you blokes aware? They're trying to teach him English, English, too, heaven knows why, and it keeps coming out like Cary Grant. That Jerry, old Jerry, you know, has been in that, the Hague there, shooting his bloody rockets at that London, eh, and using the Royal Dutch Shell headquarters building at the Yosef Israel plane, if I remember correctly, for a radio guidance transmitter. What bizarre shit is that, old man? Bounce stares at him, jingling his gastric jewelry, not knowing what to make of Slothrop exactly. I mean, Slothrop now working himself into a fuss over something that only disturbs him, dimly. Nothing to kick up a row over, is it? Doesn't it strike you as just a bit odd, you Shell chaps working on your liquid engine, your side of the channel, you know, and their chaps firing their bloody things at you with your own blasted Shell transmitter tower, you see? No, I can't see that it makes... What are you getting at? Surely they'd simply have picked the tallest building they could find that's in a direct line from their firing sites to London. Yes, and at the right distance, too, don't forget that. Exactly 12 kilometers from the firing site, hey? That's exactly what I mean. Wait, oh, wait, is that what he means? Well, I'd never thought of it that way. Neither have I, Jackson. Oh, me neither, folks. Hilary Bounce and his puzzled smile. Another innocent, a low-key enthusiast like Sir Stephen Dodson Truck, but proverbs for paranoids, too. The innocence of the creatures is in inverse proportion to the immortality of the master. I hope I haven't said anything wrong. Why is that? You look, Bounce, aspirating what he means to be a warm little laugh, worried. Worried, all right, by the jaws and teeth of some creature. Some presence so large that nobody else can see it. There, that's that monster I was telling you about. That's no monster, stupid, that's clouds. No, can't you see? It's his feet. Well, Slothrop can feel this beast in the sky. Its visible claws and scales are being mistaken for clouds and other plausibilities, or else everyone has agreed to call them other names when Slothrop is listening. It's only a wild coincidence, Slothrop. He will learn to hear quote marks in the speech of others. It is a bookish kind of reflex. Maybe he's genetically predisposed. All those earlier Slothrops packing Bibles around the blue hilltops as part of their gear, memorizing chapter and verse, the structures of arcs, temples, visionary thrones, all the materials and dimensions, data behind which always, nearer or farther, was the numinous certainty of God. Well, what more appropriate way for Tyrone to get it one cold morning than this? It's a blueprint of a German parts list, reproduced so crummy he can hardly read the words. Vorrichtung für die Isolierung 0011-5565/43. Now what's this? He knows the number by heart. It's the original contract number for the A4 rocket as a whole. What's an insulation device doing with the aggregate's contract number and a DE rating, too, the highest Nazi priority there is? Not good. Either a clerk at OKW fucked up, which is not unheard of, or else he just didn't know the number and put the rockets in as the next best thing. Claim, part and work numbers all have the same flag note, which directs Slothrop to a document SG-1. Flag note on the flag note says, Geheime Kommandosache. This is a state secret in the meaning of Section 35, R5138. Say, he greets General Wyvern, nipping in through the door, I'd like to get a hold of a copy of that document, SG-1. Ha, replies the General. So would our chaps, I imagine. Quit fooling. Every piece of Allied intelligence on the A4, however classified, gets stuffed into a secret funnel back in London and all comes out in Slothrop's fancy cell at the casino. So far they've held back nothing. Slothrop, there are no SG documents. First impulse is to rattle the parts list in the man's face. But today, he is the shrewd Yankee foxing the redcoats. Oh, well, maybe I read it wrong. Making believe look around the paper-littered room. Maybe it was a 56 or something. Jeepers, it was just here. The general goes away again, leaving Slothrop with a puzzle, kind of a, well, not an obsession, really. Not yet. Opposite the parts listing, over in the materials column now, here's Imipolex G. Oh, really? Insulation device made of Imipolex G, huh? He kicks around the room looking for his handbook of German trade names, nothing even close to it there. He locates next a master materials list for the A4 and all its support equipment, and there's sure no Imipolex G in that either. Scales and claws, and footfalls no one else seems to hear. Something wrong? Hillary Bounce again, with his nose in the doorway. It's about this liquid oxygen. Need some more of that specific impulse data there. Specific? Do you mean specific thrust? Oops, thrust. English to the rescue. Bounce diverted. For LOX and alcohol, it's about 200. What more do you need to know? But didn't you chaps use petrol at Langhurst? Among other things, yes. Well, it's about those other things. Don't you know there's a war on? You can't be proprietary about stuff like that. But all our company reports are back in London. Perhaps my next time out... Shit, this red tape. I need it now, Captain. He goes around assuming they've assigned him a limitless need to know, and Bounce confirms it. I could send back by teletype, I suppose. Now you're talking. Teletype? Yes, Hillary Bounce has his own private Shell International Network teletype rig or terminal, just what Slothrop was hoping for, right in his hotel room, back in the closet behind a rack of all-kit uniforms and stiff shirts. Slothrop finesses his way in with the help of his friend Michelle, whom he's noticed Bounce has an eye on. Howdy, babe, up in a brown stocking-hung garret where the dancing girls sleep. How'd you like to get fixed up with a big oil man tonight? Some language problem here. She's thinking of getting connected through metal fittings to a gross man dripping somehow with crude oil, a sex angle she's not sure she'd enjoy, but they get that one straightened out, and presently Michelle is raring to go sweet-talk the man away from his teletype long enough for Slothrop to get on to London and ask about Imipolex G. Indeed, she has noted Captain Bounce now and then among her nightly admirers, noted in particular an item of belly brass that Slothrop's seen too. A gold benzene ring with a Formé cross in the center. The I.G. Farben Award for Meritorious Contributions to Synthetics Research. Bounce got that one back in 32. The industrial liaison, it suggests, was indeed dozing at the bottom of Slothrop's mind when the rocket guidance transmitter question arose. It has even, in a way, inspired the present teletype plot. Who'd know better than an outfit like Shell, with no real country, no side in any war, no specific face or heritage, tapping instead out of that global stratum most deeply laid from which all the appearances of corporate ownership really spring. Okay. Now, there is a party tonight over on the Cap, chez Raoul de la Palampepin, young madcap heir of the Limoges fireworks magnate, Georges Poudre de la Palampepin, if party is the word for something that's been going on non-stop ever since this piece of France was liberated. Slothrop is allowed, under the usual surveillance, to drop in to Raoul's whenever the mood strikes him. It's a giddy, shiftless crowd out there. They drift in from all corners of Allied Europe, linked by some network of family, venery, and a history of other such parties whose complexity his head's never quite been able to fit around. Here and there, faces will go by, old American faces from Harvard or from Schaff, names he's lost. They are revenants, maybe accidental, maybe... It is to this party that Michelle has seduced Hillary Bounce, and for which Slothrop, soon as his reply from London has come nattering through, in clear, on Bounce's machine, now proceeds to dude himself up for. He'll read the information through later, singing, "With my face shined up like a microphone, and a stay comb on my hair, I'm just as suave as an ice cream cone, say I'm Mr. Debonair." And turned out in a green French suit of wicked cut with a subtle purple check in it, broad-flowered tie, one at the Trente et Quarante table, brown and white wingtip shoes with golf cleats and white socks, Slothrop tops off now with a midnight blue snap-brim fedora and is away clickety-clack out the foyer of the Casino Hermann Göring, looking sharp. As he exits, a wiry civilian, disguised as the Secret Service's notion of an Apache, eases away from a niche in the porte-cochere and follows Slothrop's cab out the winding dark road to Rowell's party. Turns out some merrymaker has earlier put 100 grams of hashish in the hollandaise. Word of this has got around.
There has been a big run on broccoli.
Roasts lie growing cold on the room-long buffet tables. A third of the company are already asleep, mostly on the floor. It is necessary to thread one's way among bodies to get to where anything's happening. What's happening is not clear. There are the usual tight little groups out in the gardens, dealing. Not much spectacle tonight. A homosexual triangle has fizzed over into pinches and recriminations so as to block the door to the bathroom. Young officers are outside vomiting among the zinnias. Couples are wandering, girls abound, velvet-bowed, wild-sleeved, underfed, broad-shouldered, and permed, talking in half a dozen languages, sometimes brown from the sun here, others pale as death's vicar from more eastern parts of the war. Eager young chaps with patent leather hair rush about trying to vamp the ladies, while older heads with no hair at all prefer to wait, putting out only minimal effort, eyes and mouths across the rooms talking business in the meantime. One end of the salon is occupied by a dance band, and an emaciated crooner with wavy hair and very red eyes who is singing Julia Foxtrot. Julia, would you think me peculiar if I should fool you into giving me just a little kiss? Julia, no one else could love you trulier. How I'd worship and bejule you if you'd only give me just a little kiss. Ah, Julia, my poor heart grows unrulier. No one oolier or droolier could I be longing for. What's more, Julia, I would shout hallelujah to have my Julia in my arms forevermore. Saxophony and Park Lane kind of tune, perfect for certain states of mind. Slothrop sees Hilary Bounce, clearly a victim of the hallucinogenic hollandaise, nodded out on a great puff with Michelle, who's been fondling his I.G. Farben trinket for the past 2 or 3 hours. Slothrop waves, but neither one notices him. Dopers and drinkers struggle together without shame at the buffet and in the kitchens, ransacking the closets, licking out the bottoms of casseroles. A nude bathing party passes through on the way down the sea steps to the beach. Our host, that Rowell, is roaming around in a 10-gallon hat, Tom Mix shirt and brace of 6 guns, with a Percheron horse by the bridle. The horse is leaving turds on the Bukhara rug, also on the odd supine guest. It is all out of shape, no focus to it until a sarcastic flourish from the band, and here comes the meanest customer Slothrop has seen outside of a Frankenstein movie. Wearing a white zoot suit with reet pleats and a long gold keychain that swings in flashing loops as he crosses the room with a scowl for everybody, in something of a hurry but taking the time to scan faces and bodies, head going side to side, methodical, a little ominous. He stops at last in front of Slothrop, who's putting together a Shirley Temple for himself. You, a finger the size of a corn cob, an inch from Slothrop's nose. You bet! Slothrop dropping a maraschino cherry on the rug, then squashing it as he takes a step backward. I'm the man, all right, sure. What is it? Anything? Come on. They proceed outside to a eucalyptus grove where Jean-Claude Gong, notorious white slaver of Marseille, is busy white slaving. Hey, you! Hollering into the trees. You want to be a white slave, huh? Shit, no, answers some invisible girl. I want to be a green slave. Magenta, yells somebody from up in an olive tree. Vermilion! Think I'll take up dealing dope, says Jean-Claude. Look, Slothrop's friend, producing a craft paper envelope that even in the gloom, Slothrop can tell is fat with American Army yellow seal script. I want you to hold this for me till I ask for it back. It looks like Italo is going to get here before tomorrow, and I'm not sure which one. At this rate, tomorrow's going to get here before tonight, Slothrop interjects in a Groucho Marx voice. Don't try to undermine my confidence in you, advises the large one. You're the man. Right, Slothrop, tucking envelope inside pocket. Say, where'd you get that zoot you're wearing there? What's your size? 42, medium? You shall have one. And so saying, he rumbles off back inside. Hey, and a sharp keychain, Slothrop calls after. What the heck's going on? He wanders around asking a question or two. The fella turns out to be Blodgett Waxwing, well-known escapee from the Caserne Martier in Paris, the worst stockade in the ETO. Waxwing's specialty is phonying documents of various sorts, PX ration cards, passports, soldbücher, whilst dealing in army hardware also as a sideline. He has been AWOL off and on since the Battle of the Bulge, and with a death rap for that over his head, he still goes into U.S. Army bases at night to the canteens to watch the movies, provided they're westerns. He loves those shit-kickers, the sound of hoofbeats through a metal speaker across 100 yards of oil drums and deuce and a half ruts in the foreign earth makes his heart stir as if a breeze blew there. He's got some of his many contacts to run him off a master schedule of every movie playing in every occupation town in the theater, and he's been known to hotwire a general's jeep just to travel up to that Poitiers for the evening to see a good old Bob Steele or Johnny Mac Brown. His picture may hang prominently in all the guardrooms and be engraved in thousands of Snowdrop's brains, but he has seen The Return of Jack Slade 27 times. The story here tonight is a typical World War II romantic intrigue, just another evening at Raoul's place, involving a future opium shipment being used by Tamara as security against a loan from Italo, who in turn owes Waxwing for a Sherman tank his friend Theophile is trying to smuggle into Palestine, but must raise a few £1,000 for purposes of bribing across the border, and so has put the tank up as collateral to borrow from Tamara, who is using part of her loan from Italo to pay him. End of side 8. Chain side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.